Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So kids are going back to school as we're being vaccinated. We're seeing across the country the movement towards reopening our school. I know my local school, they're starting talking about more days in the classroom. And I'll tell you, I don't think it's a great idea. We're so close to the end of the year. I thought we should have just stayed with the 2 days on, 3 days of homeschooling kind of thing. Wait till next year when we're all kind of got this figured out. People are vaccinated. But, hey, you got people going, no, we got to have it now because our kids are going to lose a year. And I'll tell you, I'm a little concerned. My youngest is in sixth grade. My oldest graduated, my middle child, in his first year in high school. A little concerned that as they go through, they're going to fall off. And the idea of learning loss is something that's been thrown out at us, which is why I've asked Rush Walsh to come talk with us. He's a teacher, literacy specialist, curriculum supervisor, and college instructor. He's got a piece out on learning loss and, maybe why our concerns and our fears are a little misplaced. Russ, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be with you.
So as a parent, I'll be honest with you. I'm a little concerned. It's been a year and a half. We've been going through this whole pandemic thing. It's been a solid year, a little over. I worry kids not in school, maybe not doing the work they would have done. I'm worried that their future is going to be a little diminished. Misplaced or accurate concern?
Well, I think everybody should be concerned, and kids not being in school is a concern for all of us. I heard you saying that you have young children. I have grandchildren myself who are first graders and kindergartners, and I'm concerned about them too. But tell you the truth, my biggest concern is more of a social emotional concern that kids are not in classrooms making friends, learning how to work with others, negotiating the world with others, and that kind of thing. That's the biggest concern. As far as the learning loss is concerned, I think much of that is a construct of the test makers and those who would think, tell us that learning is this commodity that we can measure. And I don't think the real learning is that. I mean, sure, you remember, of course, after you left high school, maybe you forgot your high school Spanish in a couple of years, and if we define that as learning loss, then, kids are all going to suffer some loss in that way. But as far as the real skills and the things that we know, that we learn how to do and process in school, I think we have a lot less to worry about there, because it's a little bit like riding a bike. If we don't ride a bike for a while, it might take us a few times back on the bike to get really proficient at it again, but with a little practice, we'll be fine. And I think we really need to worry about the social emotional support that the kids need.
No, I don't disagree with that. I think and I look at my kids, and again, I bring them to what I see every day. I think academically, they've done okay. They've had all the things that they need: the computer, the internet. We've gotten the interaction that with the teacher and stuff, and very happy with all of that given the situation that we're in. It has been the lack of being able to go and participate in classroom activities and that socialization that I think is equally important to learning math and reading and the rest of it that they've lost out on.
So if we look at something like mathematics, okay, so the kids, much of mathematics is procedural, and if you're not practicing those procedures at a regular basis, you can get out of practice with it. But you get back into practice with it, and it moves along. So I'm not so concerned about that.
Right.
I think if you look at learning loss, a lot of the discussion about learning loss comes from research that shows that kids seem to lose some learning over the summer. But the truth of the matter is that that research isn't all that robust, and there are ways that we can combat it. One of the best ways to combat it is to make sure that kids are having plenty of opportunities to read, and read on things that they self-select, read on things that are their own interest, and opportunities to talk about what they're reading, and, you know, that can be done. It's not perfect, but it could be done in a Zoom session. It could be done with parents. It could be done with the teacher. The teacher can set up Zoom groups in their classrooms where the kids can talk to each other. Yeah. And the other thing I would say that kids need to be doing is they need to be writing. So I did a piece on my blog, Russ on Reading. I did a piece about learning loss, and then I followed that up with my own prescription. So I think if teachers are encouraging kids to do plenty of reading, plenty of writing, and then providing with some opportunities to share, that the fears about learning loss can be diminished quite a bit.
Yeah, but, you know, you brought up, you know, the learning loss that happens over the summer. All of us, you know, went through that every year. Every year we would come back and we had forgotten a lot of what we learned the year before. And, you know, we had a little refresher. We caught back up. It just seems to me we're going to need a little bit longer of a refresher. And so how do you see schools, how do you think that they're going to react come fall? And I'm hoping we're through most of this in the fall and things get back to somewhat near normal. And I know I'm being overly optimistic, so don't chastise me for being that optimistic. But I'm hopeful that, you know, come the fall, this is somewhat behind us. People are vaccinated and we've got things more under control. How do we then, you know, bring people up to speed, make sure that kids, you know, don't have the loss that even we would have gotten over the summers?
Okay. So I think you're exactly right. I think it's a good thing to be hopeful. And I think you've already mentioned some of it. So I think teachers are really good at assessing where kids are. And, you know, so as we go back in the fall, I would be looking for teachers to be assessing kids. And, you know, different kids are going to have different reactions to all of this. And, you know, so different kids are going to be in different places. So we're assessing where they are. And it's exactly as you said, what kids need a refresher here, what kids need a refresher there, what kids don't need a refresher, and we could be moving on with them and doing that kind of assessment in the fall. It's that kind of assessment that is so powerful. You know, the kinds of assessments that are often talked about in learning loss are standardized tests, which teachers don't often find very helpful. And I think standardized tests are going to be particularly not helpful right now with the kids not being at school and with what we know about online learning being not as robust as in-person learning. So that's what I'm looking for. Teachers to assess where the kids are, providing refreshers, and then moving ahead with the curriculum as they have it in place. Now, obviously, if you miss out in some way or another on an Algebra 1, then maybe there has to be a longer refresher on Algebra 1 before you move into Algebra 2.
Right.
But again, I think there's time and opportunity to do those kinds of things, and I think we can. I think there's enough time in any of these subjects to do some acceleration and get the kids up to speed without beating them up and overwhelming them with homework, without sending them to summer school. I think we can do it with good, solid teacher assessment and good instruction.
I've had people who have thrown at me that maybe we should hold everybody back a year and redo this year. Are we a supporter of that idea or no?
Oh, we are not a supporter of that idea. the kids should be moving along. We have plenty of data that shows that any kind of holding kids back actually does more damage than it does good. We can, I believe there is enough room in any of these curricula that that we can move forward the way we've been and without holding kids back. And I think the kids will be fine. I think some of the parents might need their hands held, but I think the kids will be all right.
I mean, look, as a parent, I want to make sure that my kids have this one opportunity to get an education. And I think every parent looks at it this way. They've got one shot. And we don't want them to booger up that shot like we did and make the same bad mistakes that we made. So we want them to do better. And this is kind of a major break in what normally would happen. We want to make sure that they get everything they can get academically out of this. So I'm glad to hear you think that we're going to catch up and everything's going to be okay. It's all going to basically come out in the wash.
I think it'll come out in the wash. But one of the things I think we might want to not miss also is look at the special learning that our kids have had over the past year. You know, our kids, I didn't have this experience growing up. I mean, I grew up in the time when the polio vaccine came out, and everybody was so glad to have that and save so many people's lives. But look at the experience our kids have had this year with sort of how we cope with different things that get thrown at us.
Yeah.
This is the kind of learning that you can't get in school. There's some real world learning going on here. A lot of kids are learning how to negotiate learning on the internet like they never have learned before, out of necessity.
So, yeah. No, learning how to adapt. You're absolutely right.
Every challenge gives us an opportunity, too. So there's lots of opportunities here. I think there's been opportunities for families to get closer together, to spend more time together. And you know, there's a lot of research that shows that that kind of family interaction can be very supportive of kids as they continue in their learning. So, you know, if we look at these things as opportunities, I mean, I've been stuck at home for a year, and I took the opportunity to do some more writing and some more reading and things that I hadn't had the opportunity to do before. If we look at it that way as an opportunity rather than a loss, I think we're all better off.
Yeah, I'll tell you the opportunity that I've taken from all this. A year and a half ago, I had some reservation and some concern that cyber charter schools were going to be a thing of the future. I'm not so concerned now because I think everyone has seen what cyber charter schools look like, and I don't think that that's an immediate concern going forward. I could be wrong, but everybody I talk to, not thrilled with doing the online education thing.
Well, we have a lot of data now, don't we? And we didn't really have a whole lot of data before, but we see the value of human interaction, which is something that many of us, veteran teachers have been arguing for, that the quality of human interaction is so important in the learning environment. And so, I mean, certainly the online can provide all kinds of supports, and the research is wonderful, and having all of this, having the world at your fingertips like that is just fantastic. But, you know, how you shape that and form that information into learning, it's a very social activity.
Excellent point.
Learning is social, so we need to get kids together with other kids in schools, and we need to have teachers facilitating their conversations.
No, I'm right there with you. So the last line of questioning to go through then, because we've talked about the academic. You seem to be very confident that our kids are going to catch up and they're going to be okay. And I want to believe that, and I'm hoping I can believe that. The other side is social, and that's, for me, just as big as the academic, because, you know, to be a citizen, you got to figure out how to get along with others. And, you know, as you've said, you know, we've kind of been sequestered in our worlds. Any advice on how we socialize more, how we get kids to do more, or is this kind of overthinking it on my part? They'll be fine. They'll figure it out. Is that the answer?
No, I don't think it's the answer for every child. You know, and different kids are going to react to this in different kinds of ways. I think we need to be very aware of our own children and our own family and just how are they responding all of this. What are their anxiety levels? Do they need to talk? Do they need some counseling? I think we need to look closely at that. I think actually more closely at that than the whole learning loss construct is this social concern. So I think we need to monitor that closely, you know, and when opportunities arise for some social interaction, to try and provide them. And, you know, that's the biggest reason to me, to get schools open as soon as we safely can. And still, I mean, none of these things make any sense unless the kids and the teachers are safe in the classroom. And like you, I'm hoping that in the fall that happens and the kids are back together again. But up until that time, no, I think it's a serious concern. And I think we need to be watching our kids, seeing how they are responding to this, making sure that they're not closing themselves in their room for inordinate amounts of time, making sure they're getting some fresh air, making sure they get some mom and dad time, taking out the board games and doing some socialization around the dinner table. That seems to me to be something we need to be aware of, need to be doing.
I'm right there with you. And when things, you know, come back to somewhat near sane, maybe a little safer, get back into those social situations and go from there.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping everybody gets vaccinated. I hope these variants don't overwhelm us, and that, you know, in the fall, everybody's back to something close to normal.
We will see how this plays out, but I'm glad to hear that you think everything's going to be okay. Allay some of our fears that our kids are going to fall behind, because I know most parents I know, we were worried about our kids, worried that they're going to miss this opportunity. But I'm hoping that everything's going to be all right. Russ, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Great talking with you, my friend.
Thank you very much, Rick. Take care.
Look, you know, I think we all are kind of in the same world. I want to make sure that the kids get the best education they can, that they have the best opportunities, and that they don't fall behind. And we'll see. We come back to the reality that kids are resilient. They'll bounce back. As I say all the time, you know, I don't do roof work anymore because I don't bounce like I used to because I'm older. Kids bounce back. They bounce well. At least I hope so. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Do you think it's a problem? Do you think academics is more important than socialization? Maybe if we socialized more, maybe if we got along better, we wouldn't be shooting each other as often. Or maybe if we didn't have as many guns. Just a thought. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day the Taylor Law went into effect in New York State. It was celebrated for granting public employees the right to organize and elect union representation. But it's also roundly criticized for stripping public sector workers of their right to strike. It was crafted and enacted in response to the militant, victorious New York City transit strike of January 1966. The Taylor Act amended key points of the 1947 Condon-Wadlin Act, which first prohibited public sector strikes in the aftermath of a teacher strike in Buffalo. But strikes persisted, and the act was seen as largely unenforceable. In the aftermath of the 1966 transit strike, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller appointed a committee chaired by labor relations professor George Taylor to make, quote, proposals for protecting the public against the disruptions of vital public services by illegal strikes, while at the same time protecting the rights of public employees. In addition to granting the right to organize, the Taylor Act also establishes impasse procedures for dispute resolution, defines and prohibits improper practices, prohibits strikes by public employees, and established the Public Employment Relations Board. But public sector unions argue the law gives no incentive for employers to settle disputes or negotiate contracts in a timely manner or in good faith. While public sector unions have struck since its enactment, Transport Workers Union 100 was subjected to harsh fines in both the 1980 and 2005 transit strikes. During the 2005 walkout, TWU 100 was issued a $1 million a day penalty, its automatic dues collection was suspended, and its leader Roger Toussaint was jailed for 10 days. The union continues to push for changes to the law. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I keep putting hope into the fact that, you know, I want to believe that we're going to get vaccinated. I want to believe that we're going to get to the other side of this virus, of which, interestingly enough, there are still people who are going, no, it's all a hoax. It's no big deal. Oh, we've overreacted. And then you see Ted Nugent, who, again, Mr. It was a hoax, didn't matter. Now talking about, oh, I've got it, and it's horrible, and And who knows? Maybe he doesn't even make it through. Now it's real. Same thing with Sarah Palin and others. Oh, now it's real. Now that I've got it, now it's real. And that's one of those weird things. Now that you get it and you have to suffer through it, now it's real. But when it's somebody else's problem, when it's an abstract, it's all a hoax. And this is one of those weird kind of spaces because I think, you know, come the next couple of weeks, months, as, you know, the vaccine becomes more available, we're at 200 million people being vaccinated already in a country of 330 million. So we're almost two thirds of the way there, which means it's the last bit of the most recalcitrant, the hoax class, the MAGA people, the Trump voters, basically. They're the ones who are, no, I'm the anti-vax nitwits. It's them who's going to, I'm not going to get vaccinated. I don't have to. I have freedom. I have the freedom to do what I want. I look at this story from Kentucky. New York Times has a story of this nursing home in Kentucky where one worker, one guy, one person decided not going to get vaccinated. I'm special. It's my freedom, my liberty. If I want to go without getting a vaccine, my thing. Evidently infected 26 residents of this nursing home. They're right. It's their right to not be vaccinated. And this is one of those things that I talk about all the time. You have the right to do whatever you want to do unless your right infringes on my right or others. So this one person set off this chain of 26 residents at this facility being infected, 18 who had already been vaccinated. And evidently, there were a bunch more healthcare personnel who were infected. Four, I guess, who had been vaccinated as well. Two of the unvaccinated residents evidently died. So this is one of those things where you go, do you have the right to say, I'm not going to do it, and then be able to go into the public spaces, such as an employment situation, and assert your right in that space where you're going to affect your coworkers in a nursing home, vulnerable population of residents? And what is the law going to be going forward? Because I don't know that I support mandatory vaccinations. I don't know that I'm in the camp of we're gonna make you, we're gonna grab you, we're gonna have the police come to your house, kick in the door, throw you to the ground, and just jab it in your arm. I'm not in that camp. I know some people who think we should be doing that. I'm not there. But I am in the place of going, you know what? If you choose not to, that's your right. It's your right not to be vaccinated, but it's also our right not to allow you into our spaces, such as a nursing home with a vulnerable population. And this is where the freak out on the right wing over these vaccine passports, which again, not thrilled with, but I understand. When I take the kids, when we sign the kids up for school, we had to show vaccination records. And the only way you got out of it is you say, no, we're religious. God doesn't want us to have vaccines, which is just stupid. Again, I go back to my friend who, reached into the box to pick up the snakes. And when he got bitten, I said, well, why didn't you die? Because we've got the anti-venom back. And I said, well, if the snake biting you is God's will and you're new to die, didn't you usurp God's will? No. God wanted us to have the anti-venom. God wants us to have the vaccines. So for my religious friends, God wants us to have vaccines. God wants us to protect ourselves, lead our best lives. And here's the other big one. I know people of religion will understand this one. Love thy neighbor as thyself. I would amend that, since there are a lot of people who are not loving themselves, maybe a little bit better than yourself. Maybe the way you want people to treat you. And I look at this vaccine as one of those things. Look, I understand there are some people who are going to have certain circumstances where, it's not medically smart to do, and you're willing to get the virus and go that route. I kind of get that. But that's a very small population. Most of the people I know are just, well, I read it on you. I saw it on YouTube. Some guy, some Cletus or Cooter, on YouTube came up with a video that he saw, this is why we can't do it. That's not an excuse. That's not a medically sound reason. So it's going to be interesting to see in the coming weeks and months how employers deal with folks who aren't going to do it. And for any reason. And what's crazy to me is, the study we saw from Ohio, where a large number of people who work in healthcare facilities were the first ones who are going, nope, not going to do it. Where they should have been the first ones going, no, I got to protect myself from this because this is dangerous. And having the medical training to know that these vaccines are incredibly safe. The fact that the Johnson & Johnson was paused because six women got blood clots, six, and our FDA said, we're going to put the brakes on this till we know more, tells you that it's incredibly safe. Just because six people out of 200 million had a reaction. Now, we're going to stop it and you can't get it. I mean, think about it. Let that sink in for a minute. We definitely live in interesting times. Love to hear your thoughts, though. What would you do in the workplace if someone wasn't vaccinated? Do you stay away from them? Do we make them wear masks? What's the way for society to protect itself from those folks who believe it's their freedom and their right and their liberty to infect everyone else and to, harm others? Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Nay is gonna be here to share some thoughts on the top issues of the day. Right back.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
This is a frightening report.
UN Global Climate Assessment warns climate change and sea level rise are accelerating. U.S. and China agree to cooperate on climate action. Plus,
how about the 40,000 people plus that's lost their jobs in this industry just in about 10 years?
Nation's largest coal mining union backs shift from coal mining to renewable energy jobs.
All of those exciting shifts and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Hi, I'm Kevin McCarthy.
Hi.
Welcome to the Energy Innovation Agenda.
Oh, he meant that.
Democrats often dismiss Republicans as being disinterested in addressing global climate change. This is just false.
Well, that's true. If by false, he means true. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, does Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy realize that gaslighting is not an actual energy source?
Apparently not. Let the gaslighting begin.
Begin? Will it ever end?
So let's start here.
With real news.
Yes.
Go ahead.
We've got a big climate week this week. On Earth Day, on Thursday, President Joe Biden will host a 2-day virtual leaders summit on climate to try to regain credibility among the international community that the U.S. is back and ready to work on climate action for reals this time.
That sounds virtually exciting.
Based on Biden's American Jobs plan to transition the U.S. economy away from fossil fuels. Plus, the White House also hopes to push other countries to ratchet up their targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions that cause the climate crisis. Associated Press summarized Biden's tricky task as, quote, how to put forward a non-binding but symbolic goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that will have a tangible impact on climate change efforts not only in the U.S. but throughout the world.
That's a lot of words.
Speaking of around the world, a pretty big diplomatic development in advance of the summit, the U.S. and China on Sunday formally agreed to cooperate on climate change, a crucial agreement between the world's two biggest emitters amid rising tensions between the two countries.
That's big news.
The joint statement reads, quote, both sides recognize climate change is a serious and urgent threat to the survival and development of mankind, and both countries will, quote, continue to discuss concrete actions in the 2020s to reduce emissions aimed at keeping the Paris Agreement aligned temperature limit within reach.
Nice.
And it matters because on Monday, the World Meteorological Organization released its annual State of the Global Climate Report. The report finds that climate change did not stop for COVID-19, but the pandemic exacerbated the challenges of extreme weather, food and water insecurity, and the displacement of vulnerable populations in developing countries. Sea level rise and ocean acidification are accelerating, and 2020 saw new records in droughts, wildfires, and extreme heat waves. In a press conference, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on developed countries to help developing countries adapt to climate impacts and do more to cut their own emissions, saying this is a make-or-break year to confront the global climate emergency.
Anthropogenic climate change, climate disruption caused by human activities, human decisions, and human folly. And the effects are disastrous. This is truly a pivotal year for humanity's future. And this report shows we have no time to waste.
Fakest accent I've ever heard.
Here in the U.S., the nation's largest coal miners union on Monday said they would accept President Biden's American Jobs Plan to transition the nation away from coal and other fossil fuels in exchange for a, quote, true energy transition.
Really?
With new renewable energy jobs and investment in their communities, including development of technology to capture carbon emissions from coal plants. Union President Cecil Roberts said ensuring jobs for displaced miners, including 7,000 coal workers who lost their jobs in just the last year, is crucial to any infrastructure bill taken up by Congress.
I think we need to provide a future for those people, a future for anybody that loses their job because of a transition in this country, regardless if it's coal, oil, gas, or any other industry for that matter.
Wow, though, this is big news. The coal miners union is saying we're cool with giving up our jobs so long as you give us other ones to replace them.
Exactly.
Big news.
Finally, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland on Friday revoked a number of Trump-era orders that expanded fossil fuel development on the public's lands, calling them, quote, inconsistent with the department's commitment to protect public health, conserve land, water, and wildlife, and elevate science. Among those actions, Haaland revoked Trump's rollback of a moratorium on federal coal leasing and revoked his orders to expand oil drilling in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve, and she moved to make climate change a priority in agency decisions.
Nice. Let the revoking continue. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta say, I don't know why the Democrats keep going back to Joe Lieberman. Can't we just leave him alone? Jeez, well, evidently the Senate Democrats are bringing Joe Lieberman. The title was as a ringer. Joe Lieberman as a ringer on anything. Sounds like a bad idea. But in this case, it's pushing the idea of statehood for Washington, D.C. I think Washington, D.C. should be a state. I think we should go in that direction. But Joe Lieberman should stay the hell out of it. Just my thoughts. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, maybe a little bit on Joe Lieberman. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney, to come talk with us. Bob, thanks for taking time.
Well, thank you, Rick. Are you talking about the same Joe Lieberman that when President Obama brought forth his signature health care bill that he did an amendment or pulled out of the bill for the insurance companies of his state to make sure that the Obama plan for 55 and above that were falling through the cracks would then not have coverage under Medicare, same Joe Lieberman?
That's Joe Lieberman.
That one. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Now, would you like me to comment on it?
No, that was also the same Joe Lieberman who threw Kerry under the bus during that election. The same Joe Lieberman who made sure that corporate America, well taken care of, tax breaks, all that. Yeah, the same neoliberal Joe Lieberman that we all know and don't really love. But yes, please do then comment on Joe Lieberman as the ringer for D.C. statehood.
This one, whoever came up with this idea, obviously, I don't know, maybe it was somebody in the Senate, because Joe Lieberman has a close relationship with Republicans, and that'll help Democrats make their case, is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, Joe Lieberman will not have an impact. And again, what I just said at the beginning of your show is true. This, for the insurance companies, he gutted a very important part of the ACA, Obamacare,
yep.
A very important part that would have taken care instantly of the people in the gap before, 55 to, till they could get their Medicare to 65, it would have, and they would have paid into the system. So, and I bring that up because that's a large sin in what he did with that bill.
For me, that's a cardinal sin. That's not just a large sin. That is one of the cardinal sins, because what that could have done for our economy was just huge, because we could have gotten people who are in their late 50s out of the workforce into their retired years. We could have filled those jobs with younger workers, and we would have had the turnover that we need to have for younger generations. Because most people I know who are my age and older, they're waiting. They can't wait for retirement, because financially they're okay. Healthcare wise, they just can't risk it.
Right. And the Democrats wanted to get Lieberman, and so they were dropping the public option to woo Lieberman. Is what they were doing.
Yep.
They were having to try to do that.
And
I keep staying on that bill. There's other things we can talk about with Lieberman. He switched sides so many times you don't know where he's really at or what he would have after his name. But what he did dropping the public option, that's another part of it, is absolutely, I think, unforgivable. So I don't know where he brings in anything unless he's able to go to the Republicans and say, hey, I helped. You remember when I helped you to gut the health care bill?
Yeah.
I don't think they care.
What can I help you gut now?
I don't think you'll bring any votes.
Not what can I help you gut. And look, all bringing Joe Lieberman up does for me is enrage me and other progressives and liberals and people who do remember those things, because, the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party has been basically the death of the working class for decades now. So to bring him out in something that I support, like D.C. statehood, that Republicans, I guarantee, are dead set against, I don't see how it's helpful.
Right. And at the time, he said, his quote was that if the Medicare buy-in for 55 to 64 is out and there's nothing similar, then he's getting, his quote, if I remember right, is he's getting towards the position that he's ready to vote for the health care reform.
Yeah.
So that in itself, why would you want, as a Democrat, can't you find somebody else in this large country instead of having the guy do your bidding that gutted the main provision, really, of the ACA?
No, I'm with you.
I don't see any upside for Democrats on this one.
I don't know why we keep going back to these retreads, people like Joe Lieberman. I don't get it. I don't get what it is. There must be dirt or something. He must be on retainer and we're already paying him. I don't know. But it's just bad, because here's the thing. We've just spent all of this time, and maybe this is the game plan. We've spent all this time going after Joe Lieberman. And I could go back to, I knew John Kerry was going to lose back in 2004 because he chose Joe Lieberman. Which was the first bad decision he could have made. Not the fact that he was swift-boated and didn't respond to that quick enough. Joe Lieberman was the first bad decision. But we're not talking about D.C. statehood, which is something I think is a long time in the waiting.
Right. By the way, shall we remember that he endorsed John McCain for president?
Yes.
Can we remember he endorsed Sarah Palin? Okay. I mean, people might have forgotten. He endorsed Sarah Palin, yeah. All right? I mean, some of her relatives didn't endorse her. If I remember right, he supported Donald Trump.
Now, that I don't remember. I wouldn't doubt it. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't call him Traitor Joe Lieberman for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was being, I'll give you an inside deal here. He was being considered for Ambassador of the United Nations.
Oh, I love him.
I remember these because I am not a personal Joe Lieberman fan for what he did in the ACA bill. I was 55, 56 with no insurance.
Right. That could have helped.
I wanted that, okay? So, anyway, I mean, we can go over his whole list of everything. But, again, just for the optics of it, what, you know, Joe Lieberman walks in the Capitol and he has a handshake with Chuck Schumer and then runs over to Mitch McConnell and they have breakfast? This brings no votes. This brings nothing.
And to me, it shows how badly the Democrats understand how the game is played and the optics of the game. But again, what you've got is Tom Carper, who's at the front of this, along with Gary Peters from Michigan. Evidently, Peters is going to hold a hearing on D.C. statehood there at the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Commission or committee. I guess Lieberman's going to testify is how this is going to go. I don't see Lieberman being any help.
Somebody's making a dollar somewhere. I don't know where. Somehow. Yeah. It's D.C.
Maybe it's the people who want to crush D.C. statehood. That's how they've pushed him in there. Let's put him in there and we crush it. Because, look, conservatives don't want it because it's going to mean an extra two senators. And it's going to mean that they're in the Senate. You're probably going to get two Democratic senators, which is why they're dead set against it.
Correct.
Which is why it doesn't go anywhere.
Exactly.
So let me ask you, if let's say in the perfect world, if there was an opportunity, and I think there should be, I don't think it's going to happen. It's nice to talk about, nice to push, makes us all feel good that we're talking about expanding democracy and giving people the rights and representation and all of that. I don't think it's going anywhere. But if it were, what would be the process to get this through to create another state?
Well, I think it would be, I don't know the exact legal process, but I think it would have to follow, if it's going to be statehood, it has to follow what every other state has had to follow, Alaska and Hawaii being our last two states. And, you know, you've got to have a sign-off process with statehood.
Right.
So it's an admission to the union. So they would have to have the vote. The Congress would admit the new state, and this is what happened with Hawaii and Alaska. And then it has to be, I believe it has to be ratified by the other existing states. So it would have to go, you know, state to state, I think.
Yeah, I that's how I remember it, and I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't wrong.
Yeah,
it's not a two-thirds thing, is it?
No, it's a process where the Congress certifies it's a state coming in. And then there has to be a sign-off. I mean, originally it was the, you know, 13 colonies, and then they were signing off as state by state came in. But I believe that's the process.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not up on that. I should be, but all we've ever talked about is, you know, whether Congress will admit Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, to the United States, but I think there's a process after that.
Yeah, Republicans are never going to let it happen.
I don't believe so.
They're going to block it at every opportunity because it's going to be another House seat that's going to go to a Democrat and two more Senate seats, and they're not giving up the power of how tilted the Senate is towards conservatives and Republicans. They're never giving that up.
Right.
It is that simple. Let's move along. You're from the Columbus area. You had a shooting yesterday in the minutes before the Chauvin trial. What kind of reactions going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, there's a couple of things going down. There were some protests and I'm 30 miles from Columbus. There were some protests up at the campus and also downtown. Nothing with violence, but, you know, just protests. So I wanted to make that clear. And now with the mayor, he's made some statements, and so have, you know, basically everybody involved that this is a tragedy. But They are saying, let's look at all the facts. The statement made basically by the administration in Columbus was, we don't want to move too fast, but we want to move with accuracy and speed. In other words, they weren't going to come to a conclusion in one day. There's body cam video of this. And so what I read into it is, people want to see the exact, nature of what happened, because supposedly the girl that was killed was attempting to stab another girl. Now, there'll be other questions. The three shots were fired. Should it have been one? I mean, there's going to be a whole series of things. Was she actually going to stab the other girl? So, again, everybody's, I think, within the police department and the mayor are being cautious not to choose a side on this either way right now, which I think is probably best. Overall, though, I mean, it's horrible.
It's a tragedy.
It's a tragedy. It's a teenage girl. It's a tragedy.
And it's one of those things where, I wouldn't want to be in that guy's position. I wouldn't have wanted within 10 seconds of getting out of the car, have to make a decision on do I take someone's life or not.
Well, and there's another issue here, too, and I'm not making a judgment on this, because this one's, there's a lot of unknown facts. It'd be extremely wrong for me to do that, but there's going to be a question, of course, when they look at this is, when the police officer was attempting to stop her, if she was going to stab the other girl, could a taser have been used instead of a gun? What were the amount of feet that the officer was away from the girl? There's a lot of questions like that that are going to have to be answered.
Yeah, but here's the thing. A taser doesn't work all the time. I'll tell you, and this is the position I've taken. If I'm the girl in pink, I'm grateful that I didn't get stabbed.
Of course. I mean, that's the other end to it. So, again, I think that there are people who were pushing the mayor to make a decision that this was, a wrongful shoot, but I think he's taken the right position. Look at it, obviously completely by the facts, and it's not to be rushed, but it's to be done, speedily as possible, but with all the facts laid out.
Yeah, but
I think he took the right position.
But something has to be done. I mean, there are too many the black and brown people who are being shot by police in our cities. Every day it seems like there were two today, one in North Carolina, one in California. It just seems like, I guess I should pose this as a different question. Is it that it's more frequent, or is it that we're now just, because of this instant media that we're living in, we're now seeing it more often? I wonder which.
Well, I think both. Basically, black children, according to studies, black children are six times more likely to be shot to death by the police, six times more likely. There's some statistics there. Part of it, is more awareness. I've also seen videos. There's a famous video of a guy on a motel floor begging, and he was shot because he didn't comply with how he tried to put his hand out. And he was white. I mean, there's all kinds of cases out there. But if you look at statistics, again, black children are six times more likely to be shot to death.
Is there anything? I mean, it's my view, through policy, through smart retraining, through doing other things, that we can somehow fix this, or am I just being too hopeful?
No, I'm with you, and I saw I see disturbing comments all the way around. I think your comments are very thoughtful, and I think it's the right way to think. I saw somebody made a comment yesterday that, we need to remove the police and just do better housing. We need better housing, but I'm sorry, you can do good housing all day long. You're going to have a need for the police.
Yep.
So I think we have to look at, the training, the force used. George Floyd, who would train a police officer to, when you've got a guy subdued, you keep your knee on them? Who does that? So there's an endemic problem. I think, unfortunately, the headline grabs defund the police, take away the police, put in a social worker. And then you see all these memes, I can't help you, you call your social worker. And that's unfair to the endemic problem, I think politicize, as sometimes the media does, of taking the extremes. I think what you said is the way to look at it. I think there is a hope, and it's got to be thoroughly thought out, how this is done.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, what's happened is we've we've taken all of society's ills and dropped it at the doorstep of law enforcement. You know, from closing state mental hospitals like we've done here in Pennsylvania, to our addiction crisis that we don't deal with, to, you know, mental health, addiction, you know, petty crime like the war on drugs, all of these things, you know, the minor enforcement of every single thing that happens where you're constantly interjecting police into people's daily lives that we didn't do years ago. I think we can do things smarter, and we can have different outcomes. But ultimately, as I've said from the beginning, I support the police when they're not wrong, and we need to give them more resources to do things in different ways, and everything isn't their job.
Correct. And training, I live in an apartment complex. We had a situation where a neighbor got mad at another neighbor. There was no exchange of anything, but they called the police because somebody was cutting the grass near them. And the police actually come. In fact, one time I asked the policeman, why do you come out for this? And he said, well, we have to.
Yeah, they got called.
Yeah, they got called.
And this is where, you know, this is where I go, you know, not everything has to have a policeman involved. Can't we just get along?
Correct. I mean, so yeah, there's ways to improve this. There's ways to change it. But again, when you look at the extremes, and you're right, what society expects the police to do, it's just not the way to solve it.
No, I'm right there. And again, it comes back to, for me, it comes back to policy, and it comes back to having honest discussions. And you brought up housing. A big part of our policing problem is in places where this stuff happens more frequently, in minority communities, they're generally high poverty communities. We haven't done enough. Look, I would love to see, instead of a war on drugs, there to be a war on addiction, and a war on another war on poverty, to where we make people's lives better, give them hope, opportunity, jobs more than anything, and the ability to say, look, I've got a future.
Well, you know, I sponsor people in addiction, and I see all the time. I mean, they're almost discarded in certain cases. And they're not the drug dealers. They're the people who have been addicts, and you know, people need help in communities, and you know, in housing, and addiction, and mental health, and a lot of other areas. And people say, well, that, you know, that's the way they are. Well, if you don't help them, then it becomes a problem for the entire community. But if you help them, you help that person, and you help the community both.
And I think we're at a critical moment, to be honest, because I think the awareness levels are at hyper levels.
Correct.
And that everything is just waiting to be a powder keg to explode. And this is I think, a good moment where we can say, look, we don't have a choice but to change. We don't have a choice but to address these problems in a smarter way and to try some different stuff.
Well, here's the thing about these shootings and the horrific nature of what's going on, you know, and all the other issues you and I have just talked about. We can either seize these and the hyper publicity and hyper attitude on it, seize it to make it be a good outcome and make something good happen out of these problems, or it can just continue to be the corporate media battle on these issues with headlines.
And I would argue, you know, to bring this into a political vein, this could be a moment where we actually make things worse. And I look at what Republicans are doing across the country with these anti-protest laws that basically tell me that if there's a protest, I can drive right through them. And if I kill somebody, well, you know, that's, I was defending my car.
Right. Yes.
Crazy.
It's not good.
Crazy.
That's, like I said, people go to extremes, and it's a great opportunity for people to actually solve something if they think about it that way.
There you go. Good stuff. Bob, as always, I appreciate the level-headed thoughts in the words. Good stuff.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our good friend Bob Ney. And look, you know, nobody wants this stuff to happen. Nobody wants to see bad things happen to people. And as someone who is a believer in government and the ability to pursue policy, there are opportunities. There are opportunities to go into these high poverty communities and do good things. Look, we went into places like Iraq and we just papered the place with money. We haven't done that in our inner cities. We haven't done that in our poverty communities. And I go back to what the kid at the gas station said to me. Well, you know, they blew up Hiroshima and they rebuilt that. Yeah, because of the Marshall Plan. Because we spent billions and billions of dollars rebuilding all of Europe after we blew it up, and Japan. We haven't done that in this country. We've just left it on the backs of the most vulnerable. Call it what you want. Call it reparations. Call it, bring Joe Lieberman into it and call it the Lieberman plan. As long as we are rebuilding those communities and giving people jobs, what we know, and this goes across the board. What we know, people who have gainful employment that gives them an opportunity to make their lives better, to make a go at it and support their families, keep a roof over their head, food on the table with some semblance of health and retirement security for down the road, basically a future. We know that bad things generally don't happen. We know that the crime rates go down. We know that all of the drug abuse stuff goes down. We know that the bad stuff is diminished. Doesn't mean it goes away, but it's diminished. And for me, the idea that we've got communities across this country that don't have opportunities, for whatever reason, we need to address those. And I say it all the time. I grew up in a neighborhood where we weren't on the bus line, so you couldn't get to those industrial parks where the jobs were. We need to address that. And I think Biden's plan to do some green stuff with public transit is a good step. But it's going to be a long, long haul in this. And I hope our leaders understand the magnitude of the moment. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any of today's program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, wherever you go. Going to be a long week. I'd love to hear your thoughts again. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
No longer just a parlor game, Monopoly is what's for dinner. Practically every commodity and every step in producing our family's most essential consumer purchase is in the tight grip of four or fewer global conglomerates. Four chemical giants control more than two-thirds of the world market for commercial seeds. Tyson Foods and three other meat packers control 60% of the U.S. poultry market, while just three global packers control 85% of U.S. beef market and 71% of the pork market. Four multinational grain trading powers control 90% of all grain marketed in the world. Two conglomerates control nearly half of the U.S. market for tractors and other farm machinery. The biggest buyers of farmland are multi-billion dollar Wall Street speculators, jacking up per acre prices beyond what family farmers, especially young people trying to get into farming, can pay. Indeed, the largest owner of U.S. agriculture land is super-rich tech mogul Bill Gates, who holds land in a dozen states that would amount to nearly a 400-square-mile farm, bigger than four Seattles, the sprawling metropolis where he lives. President Joe Biden has been a lifelong policy minimalist, but when running for president, he at least recognized the need to combat corporate power, promising, quote, to make sure farmers and producers have access to fair markets. Rhetoric aside, though, there is at this point no sense that he and his inside team grasp the structural enormity of what's at stake, nor have they come up with proposals to do the heavy lifting necessary to free America from the monopoly yoke. This is Jim Hightower saying, nonetheless, farm, labor, consumer, environmental, and other progressive advocates should move a broad, aggressive, anti-monopoly initiative to the top tier of our change agenda, because it can produce big, positive results for nearly every grassroots constituency. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.